Here in America, work is in trouble. We've offshored our manufacturing, sent away good jobs, and lost so much ability to make things. American Giant is a company that's pushing back against this tide. They make high-quality clothing, sweatshirts, jeans, dresses, jackets, and so much more right here in the USA. Visit American-Giant.com and get 20% off your first order when you use code STAPLE20 at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com. Promo code STAPLE20.
This is a special report from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers Podcast.
Brian Koberger back in court for another rather large motions hearing. Let's take you to the courtroom right now.
Bushy eyebrows, I think, is next. This is a defense motion.
DM is considered an eyewitness. And eyewitness testimony is some of, if not the most impactful testimony in a trial. The testimony must be subject to close scrutiny before its admission is allowed. We seek that the use of the descriptor, bushy eyebrows, be excluded from use at trial because the witness with this descriptor is completely uncertain of what she remembers, and her description is derived from seeing the intruder for only a second. Whether this court applies Manson-Biggers, which I would say is not completely right on point because there wasn't a photo lineup and there wasn't a show up, or the court considers the science behind memory, the criteria you must look at is what factors influence the accuracy of the memory and make the testimony reliable, because reliability is the linchpin in determining the admissibility of identification testimony. Between Manson-Biggers and the science of memory, there are several factors that are consistently considered, and I'm going to go through a few of those. Factor one, what was the opportunity to see? This is also known as first phase of development of memory, or the acquisition phase, and distance, lighting, and duration of exposure are important. DM is uncertain about the lighting. The stairs to her left were not lit. The kitchen may or may not have been lit. And the twinkle lights in the living room may have been lit. She described seeing the person for, quote, only a second, end quote. The person may have been 3 feet from her, or he may have been walking to exit out the back sliding glass door. The back door is further than 3 feet from her door and is not visible from where she was standing. We submitted two pictures as our exhibits to show you the vantage point of where she was standing in her bedroom. Her opportunity to see supports unreliability. Factor two, the witness's degree of attention. This is where amount of alcohol has a significant impact on the analysis. She described herself as, quote, probably very drunk, and given the amount of alcohol she told law enforcement about consuming the entire day, that makes sense. She started with champagne mimosas in the morning, then White Claws 9 to 10 throughout the day. Then that night before she got home, she was involved in a drinking game and drank Borg, which is hard alcohol and flavoring. Her degree of attention, given this, supports unreliability. Factor three, the accuracy of the description. Her description is that she saw a person wearing all black, not insanely tall. She doesn't know if she saw lips and nose. She is certain he is white. She never mentions eyebrows herself initially. The person who asked about eyebrows was law enforcement. In her second interview, Detective Mowry asked her if she saw the eyes, saw eyebrows. She said, never said anything about bushy eyebrows. Then in her third interview with Detective Gooch, she said she didn't know what the eyes looked like or the color of the eyebrows. That's for the first time that she mentioned bushy eyebrows. This lack of accuracy supports unreliability. Factor four, what is the level of certainty of the witness? In each of the five interviews, she says over and over again She doesn't know if anything she says is accurate because she felt like she was in a dream state, frozen shock, fuzzy and cloudy, like wearing blurry glasses, influenced by alcohol, and sleepy. She has an absolute lack of certainty. This supports unreliability. Factor 5, the science of memory looks to confabulation. When the acquisition of memory, the first factor that I talked about is impacted by emotion and stress. In this case, that is an important consideration. Confabulation is defined as the creation or substitution of false memories through later suggestions that fill in the gaps of missing memory. Diem expresses in each interview how she was afraid and did not know what she was hearing, and also contradicts this when she thought everything was, quote, okay, and XK was simply just passed out on the floor. Later suggestion, under this definition of confabulation, is Detective Mowry asking her about eyebrows and each law enforcement officer, then reinforcing that in each interview. She never used the word balaclava, yet Detective Gooch asked her if she had ever heard of one, explained what one was and that it's used to hide identity, showed her a picture of one, and then had her draw one. This is law enforcement filling in the gaps. This also impacts the last factor, which is factor 6, post-event misinformation effect impacting retained information, exposure to subsequent information. Law enforcement, upon initial appearance at the scene, did not ever break up all of the people that were there. They then go to the police station, and after that, on the night of November 13th, those that were at the house when law enforcement arrived stayed together in a hotel room. So the DM was basically together with other witnesses from the time that when they first called friends to come to the house, before they called law enforcement, all the way through the night. She was interviewed twice by law enforcement. That created this exposure to bushy eyebrows. And then that term was used in the probable cause affidavit, and the media seized upon it from the very beginning, causing post-event exposure, which affects how DM's memory is retained. This factor supports unreliability. When you look at all of these factors, or the totality of the circumstances, the way the state argues it, the linchpin, the reliability, is not there. The state wants to bolster a person who admittedly has no clear memory with a photo of Mr. Koberger to say, this is the person she identified. DM told police that she looked at Mr. Koberger's arrest picture and did not recognize him. The state cannot in-run around her unreliability by entering into evidence a photo to show it's a person that she says she cannot identify, because the state's interpretation is that Mr. Koberger's photo shows bushy eyebrows. That is misleading to the jury. It will confuse the jury. It will be putting words into the mouth of DM that do not exist. While they might not seek to do that on the stand with her by admitting a photo through her testimony off of his phone, if they make the argument in an opening statement that that description of bushy eyebrows is supported by a photo taken on his phone the next day, that kind of prejudice is beyond repair. The state also claims that because DM draws pictures of eyes and eyebrows, she is more reliable in her identification of them. But that is not the way law enforcement appeared to have viewed the artwork as they photographed it and reported on it. Given the science of memory and its acquisition, retention, and retrieval, this could be what is filling in her memory gaps as opposed to actual memory. When you apply the critical factors that a court must take into consideration for eyewitness testimony regarding identification, the words "bushy eyebrows" should be excluded. The heart of the issue is whether or not the witness is reliable enough on the issue to let the words be spoken to the jury when it comes to the description. DM said that she could not do a composite sketch because she doesn't think she saw a face. The court should enter an order excluding the words. Thank you.
The defendant relies on the Manson-Biggers test. We just went through the five-factor balancing test for their argument. However, that test is completely inapplicable in this case. Manson-Biggers has to do when there's a law enforcement-led identification process. The concern is that through suggestive techniques by law enforcement, it could lead to or create a misidentification. Well, that didn't happen in this case because it couldn't happen in this case. The male DM saw that night was covered head to toe. The only thing that was uncovered was a portion of his face. That does not lend itself to positively identifying any particular person. Therefore, an identification procedure was not used, and that Manson-Biggers test is inapplicable. Instead, on four separate occasions, before Brian Koberger was even identified or arrested, DM gave consistent descriptions of the male she saw in the residence that night at around 4 a.m. Every time, she described this person as being white, male, wearing all black, a few inches taller than her, she's 5'10", wearing a mask, skinny, athletic, toned build, and not a voice that she recognized. During three of those interviews, she then describes the male's eyebrows, and she describes them as being bushy. Obviously, there was some focus on the eyes or the eyebrows by investigators because this is the only portion that she could see. She never wavers in her description of the person that she saw. She's very clear about what she does remember and what she doesn't remember. Defense put the state of Mr. Koberger's eyebrows into question. In an attempt to discredit DM's testimony or description, they wrote, "Mr. Koberger does not have bushy eyebrows." But the artwork on DM's walls and the way she draws eyes and eyebrows could be described as bushy, full, or prominent. So in response, the state attached a picture of Mr. Koberger, and obviously that's a jury question, but it was taken only hours after the homicide, so the closest in time to when DM would have seen the smell. And we did this in order to, when we did apply the Manson-Biggers test, to show that it turned out to be accurate. Corroboration does not equal prejudice. The state doesn't intend to introduce, they're correct, we would not introduce that photograph through DM. We would attempt to introduce that photograph and plan on laying the proper foundation and relevancy at trial. There's no grounds to exclude this testimony. DM's the only living individual who saw the person responsible for these four homicides. Her description of the male, including any characteristics such as bushy eyebrows, is relevant to the identity of the killer. It is prejudicial, but it's not unfair. A jury should hear this evidence, and the state asks that the court rule accordingly. Thank you.
I'll be brief, but I want to circle back to where I started. To say that there's no grounds to exclude this testimony is completely inaccurate because, in fact, there is a large body of case law and a large body of science about how important this testimony is, and that's why this court must analyze the reliability going through all of the factors that I expressed. And there is not certainty with DM in what she saw, and the court now has, over a variety of motions, all of the transcripts that you can look at to understand the amount of uncertainty that she expressed.
Thank you.
Well, I'll take that issue under advisement. Text message, pardon me, 911 call.
Judge, the state seeks a pretrial ruling that the audio recording of the 911 call and a transcript of that call are an exception to the rule against hearsay. The state submits that the entire 911 call should be admitted pursuant to IRE 8032 as an excited utterance. At 11:49 a.m., BF calls her friend and to come over and check the residence. The friend and a boyfriend show up to the residence. At 11:56 a.m., BF places a call to 911. Just 7 minutes later, this 911 call was immediately after learning that HJ had something was definitely wrong within the residence, and his instruction that the girl should call 911. The statements were made were before the declarants knew their friends had been murdered the night before. The requirements of IRE 8032 are met, as this was obviously a startling event, and two, the statements were made under the stress and excitement that it caused, and that's clear by listening to that audio. The defendant has proposed that their version of the 911 transcript be used, and the state has no objection to that. And I do have a copy of that transcript and the defendant's transcript, if the court would like it. Thank you.
Well, I may ask you some more questions because it seemed to me from the briefs that the defense focused in on three particular parts of the 911 call as not falling within the exceptions. So you didn't address those specifically, but let me see where the defense is at.
Your Honor, the best place for me to start is to probably provide you with some copies of the exhibits that we're going to want to talk about. The first set I'm going to hand you was actually filed with the text messages. It's an affidavit of Josiah Roloff, and also, let me give you the extra copy. It has DMs messages broken out in bubble form. That's not all. I gave a whole separate copy for Giovanna. I think that's what I'm supposed to do.
This, to be clear, we're talking about 911, but you're giving me the text stuff?
We are. In our response to the state's motion about the 911 call, we referenced the whole copy of text messages. We just filed them with text messages, but they're appropriate here, too, for the court to consider. I have the additional exhibits that were attached to our response, and they are 1 and 1A. Two copies. With those in possession of the court, I'll talk about the state's request. The 911 call is made 8 hours after whatever happened in that house happened, after the killings happened, according to the state's theory of the case anyway. The state wants to play for the jury the 911 call and give them a transcript of the 911 call as an excited utterance or a present sense impression. The context of all of what happened that night is captured in DM's text messaging. There's a separate text messaging exhibit for BF, but it's not that all of a sudden at 4 a.m., something starts to happen, and then the 8 hours pass, and they call their friends and are startled by finding out that their roommates have been killed overnight. There's a lot more that happens during that time, and to analyze whether they're under the influence of a new and startling event, the court should take a look at all of the text messaging, all of the use of Snapchat, all of the use of Instagram that happened. It doesn't start in the middle of the night and then just stop until noon. There is a whole lot more that's going on in that house. When you hear the 911 call and you analyze each of those statements, the only statement that could possibly be a present sense impression is that from H.J., and he really doesn't say a whole lot. The other statements that the state wants to capture in, one is attributed to a person with the initials EA, and that person is repeating what she's been told. She says one of the roommates is passed out. And then a bit later, under prompt from either DM or BF, she says, oh yeah, and they saw a man in their house last night. Those are not things that relate to an exciting event. She's reporting things that other people are telling. She's not somebody who observed any event in the house. If the court takes a look at Exhibit 1 that came with the 911 calls, it's a smaller transcript, and it comes from the grand jury transcript. If the court will look at page 277, that's numbered in the top right corner, lines 16 through 24, EA did not see anybody in that house. She went in, went to the top of the stairs, and went back out, and she saw nothing. She never went back inside that house. Any statement attributed to her cannot be an excited utterance. She's repeating what other people have told her. Similarly, if you look at the grand jury transcript, this is 1A. This relates to DM. And I'm at page 187, lines 12 through 16. DM is not responding to any of the statements she makes on the 911 call to a startling event. She says that for a brief second, she saw XK, but thought she was passed out from the night before. She also wants to talk about what she saw at 4 in the morning, and the dispatcher stops her. Looking at page 190 of that same 1A transcript, DM talks a little bit about that morning when she woke up after whatever happened in the middle of the night happened inside that house, that she reviewed the text messages between her and BF from the night before. She was busy from about 9 o'clock in the morning on her phone. She was on Instagram, she was on Snapchat, she was on Indeed, she was editing pictures sometime in the night as well. This is not somebody who was asleep and then woke up and was startled. She is actively reviewing things that happened on her phone and communicating with other people. Any statements she made on the 911 call is not the result of a present sense impression. It's not the result of an excited utterance. It is somebody who's been awake and thinking about whatever she and BF talked about the night before and communicating with a lot of other people before that 911 call is made. The court should not admit the 911 call as an excited utterance. And the court should not admit the transcript for the same reason, but if the court chooses to admit one, having both is cumulative. So it asks the court to exclude the 911 call.
Judge, I think there is a misapplication of the rule as well as the event that is causing the startling event or the reason that they're startled. State agrees that this is somewhat of a culmination. There was definitely a startling event around 4 in the morning when DM opened her door and sees an unknown person in black in the house. She's not sure what to make of this, but that's obviously a startling event enough so that she runs downstairs to her friend's bedroom. Yes, a period of time elapses. She wakes up the next morning. The next startling event is the fact that when she wakes up the next morning, her friends, she can't hear them. And she's texting them, and that's what her phone records show. She's texting them, giving them time to respond, and they're not responding. So at this point, she decides to call over friends to come and check on the residents, remembering what happened the night before. Now adding to that, that she's not hearing the roommates above like she normally would, and they're not responding in the morning like they normally would. Then she calls her friend to come over. Then the friend comes over, discovers Xana, and then instructs them something is wrong, and to the point that they need to call 911. That's truly the startling event here, is the confirmation that all of these things are coming together and that there's an emergency in the house that law enforcement needs to respond to, which is the context of how all of these statements are made.
What do I do, or what's your response to the, it seems like some of this I need to take bit by bit. And so, for example, EA stating that one of our roommates or one of the roommates passed out and was drunk last night and she's not waking up. She didn't witness anything.
Well, I think that falls under her presence and suppression of what is happening at that time. Well,
her hearsay statement of what somebody else told her.
That's
she's
true.
She's not experiencing anything in that sense other than being there. And I think the case of... look at my note here. Of Bemis is instructive.
Well, I would also argue that in this, for this particular statement, we wouldn't be relying on it for that truth. So therefore, it's just not hearsay. Well, solely just for the context of the entire 911 call, but we wouldn't be asserting that what she was saying is true, that the person, the roommates, has passed out and she's not waking up. That's not the purpose, or that my friend's telling me that she saw someone in the house last night.
Tell me it's not offered for the truth. You better have a good answer about what the reason is other than the truth, and I'm not hearing one.
Only that it's part of the substance of the entire 911 call, and that part could be redacted. Which still, that doesn't mean that the entire call should be redacted.
So I'm addressing them individually. I mean, there may be parts that qualify and there may be parts that don't.
Yes. I still argue that the entire call in its entirety.
Well, so here's kind of the way that shakes out. If you offer the tape, you, as an initial matter, can't put in stuff that is hearsay, that's unaccepted hearsay. They want to put in the context, if it falls under the completion doctrine, they can. If it's the other way around, in the defense first plays the tape, and parts are hearsay or left out, and you want to complete it, you can. But you don't get to complete with hearsay your own offered conversation or I think it applies outside the federal context to recordings and testimony.
Yes, that makes sense to me.
So when you say for the whole context, that sounds like the completion doctrine, which I'm not sure you get to rely upon. Well, I know you don't get to rely upon. And so when you say it's not offered for the truth, I'm not hearing something other than the completion doctrine that you're telling me about.
I think that's fair. I mean, we only have certain exceptions to the rule. I still believe that the entire call in its entirety and under the circumstances that the call was made, the entire call could be considered an excited utterances by all declarants.
Also, there's a statement by EA, oh, and they saw some man in their house last night. Yeah. That seems to me to even be more removed. Again, it's a statement of a hearsay of somebody else, so you got hearsay within hearsay, and not by somebody who observed that and relating to the event that happened previously.
That's true.
So what non-truth purposes is that statement?
Again, I would just have to say that the whole call is
excited. That seems to me to be even more concerning.
Right.
Right. The first one, I mean, my roommates aren't waking up, and we're going to have that confirmed through other evidence. The statement hearsay that the roommate saw somebody is perhaps more of a piece of contested evidence.
Agreed. I still...
concern about being an offer for the truth is even greater there.
Right, and the appropriate remedy when there's not any grounds for relevancy for this would be to solely redact those portions of the 911 call, not to exclude the entire call. And based off of the nature of the call and the fact that the phone is passed around multiple times, and it's hard to determine who's speaking at what times, and obviously a lot of emotion in their voice considering what's going on, it's not always clear to understand what's being said. So I think a transcript is a fair way also for to convey this and should be allowed with the audio. Nothing further from the state.
Transcript and testimony. In other words, you're essentially admitting the evidence of somebody who transcribed it to say this is what they said. So to me, there's two different questions. One, should the 911 call come in? And second, should I allow, if there is a disagreement, a transcript?
Well, the state has offered to allow the defendant's transcript that they had certified.
The fact that it's certified doesn't make it otherwise independently admissible. It's hearsay. The transcript part of it.
Well, it's a transcript of the 911 call. I believe that it could be self-authenticating. It has sufficient standards of reliability built into the transcript.
That may be one. 24 might be a hook. You haven't complied with the requirements of 24 at this point, but.
No, but we haven't met our exhibit or witness deadline yet. So obviously we would have to lay the proper foundation for that and would intend to do so. Thank you.
All right, I think I need to take a statement by statement approach to this. Do you think that the surviving victims of the burglary were under the stress of the immediate events? But there are some questions about some of the other statements in there as to whether they would come in. So I think, in general, much of the 911 tape meets the qualifications, but not all of it. I think there are concerns with some of them, as I've outlined in my questions. But I will write that because to give you more particular guidance. All right, the text messages and testimony.
Thank you, Your Honor. Similar motion by the state, asking to bring in the phone records for a DM between 2:10 a.m. and 4:37 a.m. on November 13th, as well as related testimony around that same time between DM and BF. Again, the state submits that there are allowable exceptions to the rule against hearsay to allow these statements to come in. I broke those down in my motion and reply and the applicable rules for their introduction. This is a much easier piece of evidence in order to be able to present certain time periods and not put in non-hearsay. It's much easier than an audio recording where we would have to redact. But for the messages that DM sends and the messages that BF responds, I think all of those are allowable under the excited utterance, as well as the present sense impression exceptions to the rule against hearsay. If you have any questions about any specific messages.
Well, Your Honor has our exhibits already related to this, and then in the record were BF's phone activity. I don't need to quote extensively from those. There's a lot more to the text messages than the state has provided to the court, and the lot more makes a difference when you put all of these into context. We went through some of those in our briefing, and the court can see that there's even more when the court looks at the exhibit. I understand from the court's previous statement that the court would accept a complete copy of something versus just pieces of it. Well, I could offer it.
For the completion doctrine. If it's necessary to explain the prior admitted stuff and it's close enough connection in time and in subject matter, and so there are some questions there, it's not just automatic.
We certainly would understand that we'd have to present some information or cross-examine witnesses about that. The additional bits of information that are contained in that record around that same time frame, though, provide a much better context. When we're talking about other communications with social media, with saving pictures, creating new contacts in one's cell phone right before the texting starts between DM and BF, and then subsequent to that, looking at pictures, editing pictures, calling family members. There's a much bigger picture than just this tiny little piece of texting between the two parties there at night. Further context about these messages, the court should be aware that it's not just these messages. There's a lot more activity going on between these two people, and it's hard to tell what it is because there's telephone calls. And those kinds of activities, as well as going down to one another's room, spending the time together talking to each other, really take it out of an excited utterance because it's an entire transaction between the two people. It's not just a tiny little piece of context with this group of text messaging. And the whole is what matters here and takes it away from being excited utterances because of the other activities of the two people.
The activities that occur after, so for example, the texts between, you know, at 4:18 or 4:20 or whatever, those aren't affected by the later activities of, you know, surfing Instagram or whatever. And I'll be interested to hear the testimony of the two young ladies because my experience with that age group has shown that where you or I might phone somebody, others might check out their social media to see where they're at or what they're doing, right? And so understanding how they're using those apps is also important.
It is important, and I would refer the court to our affidavit from Mr. Roloff. I'm talking about the Snapchat activity, talking about Instagram, and there's a way to tell if somebody's active on Instagram versus just having it open in the background of their phone, and those are things that were going on, as well as editing pictures. The picture editing happened in those overnight hours. Instagram happened later in that morning.
That wouldn't affect the excited utterance and present sense impression of the earlier 4 o'clock text, I guess is my point, because those are afterwards. Those are after they went, retreated to the room together, and, you know, and what happened there happened there.
Mostly I agree. There were things that happened right before DM created a new contact at 3:51 in the morning. Right,
before anything happened that was of an excited nature.
If you accept the state's timeline for that, and we don't know that yet.
The foundation that will have to be laid, but that's their version of the time events, and that's then the jury's job to figure that out.
Shortly after the last text message, and I'm talking just minutes, DM and BF are doing different things on their phone that night as they get together that night. There's the period of time that they're together in that room, both before there's a break in activity. There's not really a break in DM's phone. That is pretty well continuous. And there is a break for BF, but it starts again right away. So I understand the court's looking at an isolated piece part of time, but I think it's important to understand what activity was happening leading up to that and what activity happened immediately after that when the two of them are together downstairs, to put it into context. One of the other concerns is the use of this text messaging, not just through the witness that's testifying, but to bolster each other's testimony or to bring in somebody else's statements through another person. So I think that it's important when the court analyzes if this is really an excited utterance to look at what's being said, as well as to understand the context right before and the context right after, not the next morning, the one's continuous, but right after.
That's well, there are several things that I have to look at. One is, you know, first of all, is it hearsay? Is it an assertion, right? So is it offered for the truth of the matter asserted? We get to those two things. Then we look at, is there an exception? For each of those two things, it generally means it's an out-of-court statement, that it's, unless otherwise definitionally excluded, hearsay. Unless there's an exception, then the exception being the excited utterance, and then we look at the surrounding events. Is it common or current present sense impression? Look at the surrounding events, what's said. Much of it is not assertions necessarily, or I would imagine some of it not offered for the truth, but simply to establish a timeline. And so I'll look at all of those things. But I don't think I can just look at the whole thing in whole and say, well, because they later on were doing things that, you know, 19, 20-year-olds do with their phone, doesn't mean that what happened earlier wasn't an excited utterance.
I understand. Our position is that those things that happen immediately thereafter impact the nature of those text messages that occurred between the two.
All right, next item is the demonstrative evidence.
Thank you, Your Honor. In our motion regarding demonstrative evidence, we are talking specifically about, for lack of a better phrase, a dollhouse, a not-to-scale construction, a 3D model of the residence itself. And as the court can see from the materials that have been submitted, the configuration of this house is unusual at best. Certainly, we can use diagrams and floor plans, which we did at the grand jury. But it struck us as we were looking at this case that it would be particularly helpful for the trial jury to actually be able to see in a 3D sense how everything's laid out. What is on each floor, where the bedrooms are, how the first floor
is. For it to be demonstrative evidence, what's important is whether it explains the testimony of somebody on the stand and helps the jury understand it in relation to the testimony. And the concept of a demonstrative exhibit is that it's actually part of their testimony.
Yes, Your Honor, that's exactly what I was getting at. What we contemplate is the witnesses being able to use this demonstrative evidence to demonstrate where they were, where the rooms of their roommates were, where the entries to the residence were, what they observed, and where everything was located. So it's not intended as a standalone exhibit that has significance. It's only a tool for the witnesses, not just the roommates, but the responding officers, the officers who investigated the crime scene, to point out to the jury where in this three-story structure certain things were that they observed. And so that is our intent on this. We initially contemplated doing offering a two-scale model. And the defense, I think rightfully so, said, okay, well, give us the background information and data that would be relied on. And we requested that, and for whatever reasons, we didn't get it quickly. But as we revisited, we realized that to scale maybe is not what we want. We just want a demonstrative exhibit that witnesses can use, much the same as a sketch, or if they were to take a flip pad and try to draw things, to help illustrate their testimony to the jury. So that's where we ended up here. We look at the balancing test under 403 as far as relevance. We believe this will be helpful to witnesses and explain to the jury and to the jury in understanding witnesses' testimony. As far as prejudicial effect, the state doesn't perceive any significant prejudicial effect. Now, I realize that the expert witness for the defendant talks about jurors misinterpreting angles of view and stuff. Well, that would be true if we were dealing with a two-scale exhibit. And the defense is welcome to offer their 3D imaging or whatever it is that they want to, if they want to have a two-scale presentation. That's not our intent, though. Our intent is just simply to have this as a tool to help witnesses explain their testimony and help the jury understand.
And I think you understand this, but so that, it's clear. If it allowed as a demonstrative exhibit, it's not an exhibit in the sense that it goes to the jury. When they deliberate, it will not go back with them.
Yes, we completely understand that. We intend this to be something in the courtroom that is physical, that the jury can look at and the witness can look at and point to things so the jurors have the most complete understanding of what their testimony is.
And I haven't seen it, so I don't know how visible it will be to, you've seen now where we're going to be, how visible it's going to be to the jury from where it would be presented. So I guess we'll have to cross that bridge.
And that's understood. The last communication we had earlier this week, Your Honor, from the folks at the FBI is that it might be finished within the next 10 days. I'll be candid. I had proposed to the FBI, let us get this in front of the court and get a preliminary ruling from the court before you spend the effort to construct it, but they went ahead and started anyway. So that's neither here nor there. It is intended, as you can see from State's Exhibit 1 or S1 with the dimensions in there, it's a fairly significant size, 35 by 48 by 52 inches. So the idea of making it big enough so the jurors can see it's out in the floor, in the well, and they can actually see how things are constructed and arranged. It can take apart floor by floor so they can see each floor individually and then how they are stacked back together. So that's the purpose, to assist witnesses in explaining their testimony and assist jurors in understanding the testimony.
Your Honor, we request that you exclude the state from using this dollhouse model. As is everything we're talking about here today, we're talking about Mr. Koberger's constitutional rights and we're talking about the rules of evidence. In this case, though, Your Honor, this goes beyond that. This is something that came up in 2023, the fall of 2023. We were disclosed that a group was going to the house before it was torn down to construct a model. We promptly asked in discovery to receive information about this model so that we could start to understand it, so that we could work with our expert with it. And it wasn't until 2025 that we get more information about this. I don't think that calling it a demonstrative exhibit excuses what the state has done here. The state said they didn't have any of the materials. They didn't come forth with them. Their date to be done with discovery came and went. Their date for their expert disclosures in December came and went.
Here are demonstrative exhibits, and trials are typically not brought to light in terms of being shown until oftentimes during trial itself. I mean, it's no different in some senses, as I'm hearing the argument, of sketching on a diagram on a pad.
It's completely different than sketching a diagram on the pad, Your Honor. This, if somebody's drawing something in open court, I can see them. Mr. Koberger's confrontation rights about how that's drawn exist right then and there if they're drawing something on the board. This is an exhibit that's constructed outside. It's done in preparation for court. There were experts that took the 3D imaging to make this. There were photographs that were taken to make this. There's a process to construct this. And to take it from to scale, which might have made some sense because things would be there where they're supposed to be. And by things, I mean walls, I mean doorways, I mean angles of hallways, I mean lines of sight. Those things would be there where they were supposed to be if we were doing this to scale. But to not do that and call it a demonstrative exhibit so they don't have to tell us about it is really misleading to the jury. And there's a lot of danger for the jury to be completely confused by that. I don't think this change excuses what the state did, to sit on this information and wait until the last minute when we don't have any ability to investigate it or to look at it.
You had access to the house, right?
No. What, to the old house? Yes, but not to what they're doing now.
But you had the ability to create your own models, to do your own measurements, to come to an understanding of the layout.
Absolutely, we did. What we don't have the ability to do now is to test the state's model before it gets in front of a jury, before different witnesses use the state's model to say, this is where I was and this is what I could see. If a doorway's just off, the line of sight is just off. That can be completely misleading to the jury. This is an unfair surprise to Mr. Koberger. To have this come in and have the jury look at this, it's not a PowerPoint. It's not a drawing on the board. This is going to be this big 3D model that's going to be pushed around the courtroom. It's going to draw the jurors' attention. They're going to put a lot of emphasis on it. A demonstrative exhibit that may or may not be accurate, that may have the walls and the lines in the right place or the wrong place, that won't have depictions of furniture or the way the house really existed that night. And the jury can place great weight on that. And it might not be actual. It could skew the testimony. It could skew the truth. And that's really important in this case.
Where cross-examination comes in?
Your Honor, how can I cross-examine a 3D model that's constructed outside of a way I know anything about?
Well, you had access to the house, and you know what the house looked like, and you have photographs.
I do have those things. But if there's a slight shift in this 3D model, it's going to be more difficult to depict that. And that's a lot of runs around. To try to get our expert to take a look at this, to try to get our expert to pull the 3D picture that would show that this model's wrong, and to try to get the jury to want to listen to all of that, when the best and easiest thing for the court to do is just exclude it. This is not a model that will do anything but cause the jury to speculate. It could easily produce testimony that's not true. The jury might be relying on things and likely will be relying on things that are not true. When you look at the case law that talks about demonstrative exhibits, you're looking at things like PowerPoints. You're looking at, that's in the Weigel case, whether or not the demonstrative exhibit should go back to the jury. When you're looking at the Masters case, it's an exact car seat. That was a civil case. It's an exact car seat, like was in the case at bar at that time. Here, this demonstrative exhibit that's going to be large may or may not be accurate. Conversely, I have the photographs, so does the state. I've been in the house, so is the state. There's 3D imaging that was taken by the state and by the defense. With all of the thousands of photographs and all of the people that have been through the house, there's no reason to take a chance on this exhibit that will be speculative and will confuse the jury. To allow this is allowing the state to ignore the discovery process. They're just slapping a new label on this model and saying it's not to scale, so we don't have to disclose anything to you. To allow them to rename this is a violation of Mr. Koberger's constitutional rights to due process and a fair trial. This should absolutely not be allowed. Mr. Koberger has, we have done everything we can to be apprised of what the state's going to do, and at the last minute to pull this out after we've asked in discovery for this and to label it a demonstrative exhibit, Your Honor, that just can't happen if Mr. Koberger is to have a fair trial and if his due process rights are to be adhered to. We strongly object and ask the court to order this excluded.
The 3D, or in the, I don't know if it's LIDAR or what they use, the 3D information?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
You have the laser information?
As of March 4th or 5th, I think that we did receive that. We sent that to our expert. He wrote a declaration in support of our objection to this to let you know how long it would take him to do the work necessary to even measure this, and then he'd need an on-site visit for this. And if the court allows it, that's what we have to do. But the court should be well aware that when the state does these kinds of things, these things mean taking their time and throwing things out long after deadlines come, there's a ripple effect that happens. We have to work with our expert. The expert has to carve out time in his schedule. We have to take time to understand what's happened and figure out how to respond to it. We are very close to trial, and those deadlines are important for a reason. All of the stacking up of things like this at the last minute outside of the deadline set by the court and outside of the rules further prejudice Mr. Koberger and his ability to have effective assistance of counsel at trial.
Your Honor, what Ms. Taylor is talking about might be true and applicable if we were offering a scale model. We made the decision not to. She complains about the timing of the underlying FBI data. Well, that request from her for that information related to a proposal for a scale model. And we provided it anyway because she had requested it. But in our view, it has no bearing on whether the demonstrative exhibit is acceptable and appropriate. The allegations that we've tried to sit on this and bury this, that's just silly. That's not what happened. We provided the information we received as soon as we received it. It was processed. I don't think that the defendant can point to anything to say otherwise than that. It's just simply a demonstrative 3D model to help the witnesses explain their testimony and help the jurors to understand the testimony. That's all we're asking for.
Thank you. I will give you a written decision on this soon, shortly, but there is a significant distinction between demonstrative trial exhibits or trial models, charts, things of that nature, and attempts to use things for evidentiary value in and of themselves. And the more complex, it's not particularly different than a drawing by a witness or something of that. It's not uncommon to get these very close to trial. Defense counsel has had access to the house, could have done its own diagramming if it had wanted to. It has now the information on the, I'm just going to call it the laser or LIDAR modeling measurements, whatever that was done by the FBI. It's April. Trial is in starts in August. I think there's plenty of time for the defense to respond to an item that is not actual evidence. It is simply part of testimony that will be forthcoming at trial, and will not go to the jury. They will not. Jury will not have it in its presence when it deliberates. I don't.
That's the latest from the courtroom where Brian Koberger sits and motions hearings playing out. Sure to press subscribe so you don't miss anything on this case and the many that we cover for you right here from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast. I'm Tony Bruschi. Stay with us.
This has been a special report from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast.